When we left the young lovers, they were in a state of confusion in the woods. When we left the fairies, Oberon and Titania were still having their fight. And Oberon had told Puck to go get the magic flower, and he was going to see to it that Titania is embarrassed by falling in love with a monster. And then he happens to notice the young Athenian in the forest, the young Athenian girl, Helena, desperately in love with Demetrius. So he tells Puck to find the Athenian youth, anoint his eyes with the magic potion, so that Demetrius will fall in love with Helena. And of course, there are two Athenian youths in the wood, not one, and Puck makes a mistake. It's a typical comic confusion. So we will just leave them all there for the moment and turn to that other group that I haven't said much about yet, and that is the mechanicals, the working men who are putting on their play. As I said yesterday, this is the lowest comedy. This is the burlesque. This is the farce. You put great comic actors in those roles, and they can knock each other down and poke each other in the eyes and fall over each other, and it's very funny stuff. And of course, the lines Shakespeare gives them are funny. Bottom is an egomaniac, and the rest of them aren't too bright. And, well, Bottom's not very bright himself. But the important thing to remember: these are good-hearted fellows. These are working men, and Shakespeare is making loving fun of them. He's not mocking them in any sort of mean-spirited way, but he is aware, he obviously somewhere had seen what happens with amateur theatricals, and what happens when you get people who don't know much about theater or acting or plays who decide they want to do a play. Go to any local theater and you will find Bottom and his friends still there, and they are still doing this, and it's still pretty funny. Now, I'm going to actually, for purposes of time, skip over the first scene, Act 1, Scene 2, with Quince and Snug and Bottom and Flute and Snout and Starveling. They're wonderful names as well. Peter Quince has written the play. They cast the play in that first scene. I want to leap ahead to when they get to the woods to begin rehearsing. So we are here, Act 3, Scene 1. It's the beginning, very beginning of Act 3. And they all gather together. Are we all met? Pat, pat. And here's a marvelous convenient place for our rehearsal. There's a little green space that will be their stage. This hawthorn brake, our tiring house, that is where they can retire to when they're not on stage. And we will do it in action as we will do it before the Duke. So we're ready to begin rehearsal, first rehearsal for the play. And before we can begin, there's an objection. Now, what I want to do here, this is a very funny scene, but I want you to consider the question I left you with yesterday. What is the thematic connection between love and art? We have most of the plot of the play concerning love. Young love, love at first sight with the young lovers, the potential marriage of Theseus and Hippolyta, a grown-up marriage that will come soon in the future, preparation for marriage, and the domestic disturbances of Oberon and Titania, the king and queen of the fairies who have been married a while and are now having marital troubles. That occupies most of it. Now, of course, the link that Shakespeare makes is that the mechanicals are putting on a play of Pyramus and Thisbe. I'll say more about that in a moment. It's a play, again, about young love and the troubles of young love. But what is focused on is this strange fact that you have these lower class characters aspiring to the level of the artist. They are craftsmen, so they know something about craft. And if you go through the cast list, you'll see Shakespeare makes very clear. Bottom's a weaver. Okay, every one of them has a specific profession, but now they want to make art. What is the connection between love and art? Here we go. Peter Quince finally gets ready to rehearse, and before he can begin, Peter Quince, what sayest thou, bully Bottom? There are things in this comedy of Pyramus and Thisbe that will never please. We've got a critic right away. The director's about to begin and an actor is objecting to the play before we begin rehearsals. First, Pyramus must draw a sword to kill himself, which the ladies cannot abide. How answer you that? You defend what you put in this play. We are going to offend the ladies because Pyramus draws a sword, kills himself. You can't do that on stage. Now, the Greeks would support Bottom. The Greeks believed violence had no place on stage. They considered it obscene, the literal word meaning off stage, away from the scene. Violence was something that should not be done on stage. It should be away from the scene. I don't think that Bottom's objection has that depth to it. But the fact of the matter is he senses something's wrong here. And the others join in. Barlaken and a parlous fear. I believe we must leave the killing out when all is done. Not a whit. Now notice, Bottom made the objection, but he has considered it so deeply he's already come up with a solution. I have a device to make all well. Write me a prologue, and let the prologue seem to say we will do no harm with our swords, and that Pyramus is not killed indeed. And for the more better assurance, tell them that I, Pyramus, am not Pyramus, but Bottom the Weaver. This will put them out of fear. It's wonderful. Notice, before we begin the play, we have a little prologue that says, now, there will be death in this play, but don't worry, nobody really dies. And beyond that, that fellow over there who's playing Pyramus, that's not the real Pyramus. That happens to be Bottom the Weaver. He's just pretending to be Pyramus, whereupon the audience will go, oh, thank goodness. Now, notice, that's where we begin. This gets worse. Well, Peter Quinn says, we will have such a prologue. And then Snout objects, will not the ladies be afeard of the lion? I fear it, I promise you. Masters, you ought to consider. Bottom jumps in again. You ought to consider with yourselves to bring in, God shield us, a lion among ladies is a most dreadful thing. For there is not a more fearful wild fowl than your lion living, and we ought to look to it. The answer, therefore another prologue must tell, he is not a lion. This is our second prologue. We have one of the actors who's going to come in a ratty old piece of fur, and maybe, you know, who knows, maybe a rope mane, whatever. We're not going to get an impressive lion skin like the one Hercules wore. No, no, no. But nevertheless, the women in the audience will not be able to determine that that is an actor pretending to be a lion. They will be in terror and run from the from the great hall. So now, prologue number two. Prologue number two. Ladies, that's not a real lion. That is just somebody pretending to be a lion. Again, whew, thank goodness. I was in fear of my life, okay? Bottom explains, nay, you must name his name, and half his face must be seen through the lion's neck. Again, we identify the actor, and we only have half of the face covered, so we get half lion head, half actor, and they will realize that underneath that lion is a real human being. And he himself must speak through, saying thus, or to the same defect, ladies, or fair ladies, I would wish, or I would request you, or I would entreat you not to fear, not to tremble, my life for yours. If you think I come hither as a lion, it were pity of my life. No, I am no such thing. I am a man as other men are, and there indeed, let him name his name and tell them plainly, he is Snug the Joiner. In case we don't get the point yet, here comes the next one. Well, it shall be so, but there is two hard things. That is, to bring the moonlight into a chamber. For you know, Pyramus and Thisbe meet by moonlight. Notice what we have. We have these honest, simple folks that are so rooted in reality that they assume everything in art has to be absolutely real. And that anyone who's viewing art is going to assume that what is being viewed is absolutely real. If this is called Pyramus and Thisbe, that's Pyramus. If this is a lion that comes and attacks Thisbe and chews up her mantle, then that's a lion. If Pyramus and Thisbe meet by moonlight, We've got to get moonlight into the chamber. We have hard-headed, thick-skulled realism. We have good, decent men who are firmly rooted in reality to the point that they cannot imagine anything other than the real. Doth the moon shine that night we play our play? A calendar, look in the almanac, find out moonshine. Yes, it doth shine that night. Why, then may you leave a casement of the great chamber window where we play open, and the moon may shine in at the casement. Thank heavens. They're performing on a night when the moon will be shining. We'll leave a window open, and the moon can shine in, and then they can actually meet by real moonlight. We can't pretend they meet by moonlight, because this stuff is real. I love it. Peter Quince, I or else one must come in with a bush of thorns and a lantern and say he comes to disfigure or to present the person of moonshine. Better idea. Let's have someone there as the moon. It's just getting goofy now. It's going beyond strange. Then there is another thing. We must have a wall in the great chamber, for Pyramus and Thisbe, says the story, did talk through the chink of a wall. They live in adjoining houses. They speak through a little hole in the wall. That's how they first meet. Therefore, we gotta have a wall. You can never bring in a wall. What say you, bottom? Some man or other must present wall. And let him have some plaster, or some loam, or some rough cast about him to signify wall. And let him hold his fingers thus, and through that cranny shall Pyramus and Thisbe whisper. Another problem solved. Now, this is very, very funny, but it is of enormous, enormous thematic importance in the play. These men have no imagination. What is the meeting ground between love and art? The imagination. Remember Helena's lines at the end of the very first scene. She says, love looks not with the eye, but with the mind. The eye may take in the image of a human being, but in order for love to happen, the mind has to create affection. I can look on person A, look on person B, look on young girl C, look at lovely lady D, look at E, and bingo, D interests me. I suddenly have an attachment to D. Forget A, B, C, and E. I have an attachment to D. Where is it coming from? Well, they may all be pretty. They all be nice looking. But something, ooh, attaches me, and then the process begins. And the imagination begins creating all sorts of characteristics in the beloved. Okay? Shakespeare was aware this could happen. Once we focus on someone to love, the imagination will either begin exploring the real qualities there or too often creating qualities there that will give us a reason for loving that person. Love does have to do with the imagination. We'll come back to this. So does art. So does art. The little joke here as they do their play is if Shakespeare had written the play of Pyramus and Thisbe, and it had been presented at the Globe Theater, it would have been on a bare stage with an actor playing Pyramus, a young boy playing Thisbe. It would have been presented in the middle of the afternoon, and there wouldn't have been any set whatsoever. So he would have simply put in the poetry that they meet at night by moonlight. We would have had an imaginary wall between the two families. We would have had actors playing the part, and the audience would have no problem because the audience possesses imagination. And yet, if the play was well done, and of course what we have here is Shakespeare parodying Romeo and Juliet, he had just written such a play. He didn't put an actual tomb on stage for the ending. He didn't have a prologue where someone came out and said, now this isn't really Juliet. She doesn't really kill herself with Romeo's dagger. This is a young boy. He's an actor just pretending to be Juliet, and he won't really die at the end. It wasn't considered necessary because art is of the imagination. He could imagine it, put it down, and the bond between artist and audience is the audience can imagine that that young actor is Juliet, imagine a death scene inside an imagined tomb, and the audience will be genuinely moved. The emotion will be real. The situation will be imaginary. What is the connection between the imaginary situation presentation and the real emotion of the audience? The greatness of the artist's work. The artist has to create something that is so imaginatively alive that it provokes real emotion and reaction from an audience. This is what these poor men lack. They have no imagination. They cannot imagine they could affect an audience in any way other than presenting absolute reality on stage. And that's what they're trying to do. Stated simply, none of them, but we're focusing on bottom, none of these men has any imagination. Okay? Shakespeare begins this crucial scene of the play with that fact. They then begin their little rehearsal, and Puck sees his opportunity. You want a grotesque creature for Titania to fall in love with? There's Bottom strutting around, reciting lines. But maybe we can make him even a little more obviously hideous. And since it's pretty clear that the man is an ass, let's put an ass's head on him. And that's what Puck does. And Bottom takes a little exit off to the tiring house in the Hawthorne break. He comes back on, and he is transformed. Because, curiously, these men without any imagination, putting on a play that is devoid of imagination, are out in the woods in the world of the fairy kingdom, which is pure imagination. It is a reality above and beyond physical reality. They have stumbled into a world of pure spirit. But those spirits are real, and those spirits are acting on these guys who have no idea what's going on. And Bottom is about to become part of that spirit world. But before it happens, he must be transformed. But he's not transformed by suddenly becoming sylph-like, bodiless. A little glimmer of light flickering in the woods. He's given an ass's head. If anything, he descends and becomes the visual representative of what he actually is. Out he comes, and the others scream and start running around like crazy. Bless thee, Bottom! Bless thee! Thou art translated! Now, of course, we can never see our own stupidity. Okay? It's Gogol's comment again. If they could see their own noses, they'd be horrified. Well, we can't see our own nose. That's why it's so easy to criticize others and so difficult to criticize ourselves. It is very easy to see what's out there. Bottom is still looking through the same eyes. He doesn't know he has an ass's head. He's not aware of it, but they can see it. And they run off in terror. And suddenly, Bottom is alone in the woods. He doesn't know what's happened. The rehearsal is over. His friends have abandoned him, screaming, pointing at him and screaming and telling him he's changed, and now he's all alone. I see their knavery. This is to make an ass of me, to frighten me, if they could. But I will not stir from this place. Do what they can. I will walk up and down here, and I will sing that they shall hear, I am not afraid. Well, he is afraid, but he's going to try to keep his courage up. And he walks up and down singing a little song. The ouzel cock so black of hue with orange tawny bill. The throstle with his note so true. The wren with little quill. And sure enough, who's sleeping in a bower nearby but Titania, who awakens, it's one of my favorite lines in all Shakespeare, looks on this ass, strutting up and down, singing a little folk tune, and says, "What angel wakes me from my flowery bed?" Oh, it's great comedy, folks. It's great comedy. Bottom, unaware that the fairy queen has awakened and seen him and instantly fallen in love with him, keeps singing, "The finch, the sparrow, and the lark, the plain song cuckoo gray, whose note full many a man doth mark and dares not answer, nay." The rhyme is perfect. He ends with a hee-haw. "I pray thee, gentle mortal, sing again. Mine ear is much enamored of thy note. So is mine eye enthralled to thy shape, and thy fair virtue's force perforce doth move me on the first view to say, to swear, I love thee." Bottom's response, "Methinks, mistress, you should have little reason for that." "You love me?" "Well, I don't think so." And yet, to say the truth, reason and love keep little company together nowadays. The more the pity that some honest neighbors will not make them friends. Good heart. Decent guy. The queen of the fairies looks at him and says, "I love you." And he says, "Oh, no, no, no. You really shouldn't do that." But then, love and reason don't go together anyway. Somebody should introduce them. We get a principal theme of the play. Love is irrational. This is love at first sight pushed to the ultimate extreme of absurdity. Just total absurdity. Absolute absurdity. The queen of the fairies in love with a jackass. Now, it's incongruity, but great incongruity creates extraordinary comedy. This is a little tangent, but I'm doing it to make this point. One way humor works, great humor works, is taking things that have no business going together and forcing them together. Shakespeare understood it, does it brilliantly here. This great love, and it's the centerpiece of the play between Titania and Bottom, is just ridiculous. Makes no sense, and therefore is wildly funny. I'm going to read you my favorite literary parody. There's a whole school out there, you can actually get these little books, of writers parodying other writers, okay? This is a parody of Jane Austen, a great writer. I love her. Her novels are simply wonderful. Very elegant, very witty, very social, A Woman's World, Proper Society, Love, Marriage, and written in elegant and witty prose. However, the parody here is if Jane Austen had written Crime and Punishment. So that this excerpt is from Jane Austen's novel Raskolnikov. Again, we have absolute incongruity. I quote, "Are not you happy in Herefordshire, Mr. Raskolnikov?" said Elizabeth. Raskolnikov looked into her beautiful dark eyes. His own shone with feverish brilliance. "Would you be happy," he said, "if you had killed a miserable pawnbroker?" Elizabeth turned away to hide a smile. "I hope I am not so deficient in sense and feeling as either to be capable of the attempt or to remain in spirits when the crime was accomplished," she said. "But they are not within the range of my acquaintance. Pawnbrokers are safe from me." "She was only a louse, a miserable insect," murmured Raskolnikov. "But I was wrong to kill her, and to kill Lizaveta too." "How easily may a bad habit be formed," cried Elizabeth. And with this in mind, though she hoped he was not in earnest, she very soon afterwards took leave of him. Now, we take totally opposed and disparate things, we put them together. But the other part of the humor, and the reason it's a great joke, is that we have two great writers, Austen and Dostoevsky, who probably would have talked together and had a lot to say to each other. Austen is exploring mysteries of the human soul and human behavior through questions of love and marriage. Dostoevsky is exploring aspects of the human soul through extreme situations of salvation and damnation. They would have had something to talk about, and the fact of the matter is, in the union of Titania and Bottom, we have an image of spirit and flesh. An image of spirit and flesh. They do somehow go together. And when she hugs him and entwines her arms around him, we see the low fleshly nature, bottom, rooted in reality, and the high ethereal, non-physical. You put the two together, you've got human nature. And one of the mysteries of human nature, that we are body and soul, that we are two separate things. How on earth did these two things get linked together? What is the nature of their union? And on the face of it, it would seem to be ridiculous that these things should come together. And yet, as we smile and chuckle at this little moment of the union of these two figures, we somehow know there's a truth there. We're just going to get a glimpse of it. It is done humorously. I'm not making too much of this. But Shakespeare is showing us something that is indeed, in its way, profoundly true. Now, there's one other thing to point out. Bottom, at this moment, is allowed to see Titania. The other mortals who are wandering through the woods, the young lovers never see the fairies. The other players who have come to rehearse don't see the fairies. Puck's roaming around there. Bottom sees the fairy queen and is talking with her. Out of her love for him, he is granted the opportunity to see her, and I will come back to that in just a moment. He says, well, I just want to get out of this woods. I hope I have wit enough to get out of this wood. I have enough to serve my own turn. He says, no. Out of this wood, do not desire to go. Thou shalt remain here whether thou wilt or no. And she says she'll do everything for him. I am a spirit of no common rate. The summer still doth tend upon my state. And I do love thee. Therefore, go with me. I'll give thee fairies to attend on thee, and they shall fetch thee jewels from the deep and sing while thou on pressed flowers dost sleep. And I will purge thy mortal grossness so that thou shalt like an airy spirit go. Peas blossom, cobweb, moth, and mustard seed, and four little fairies are right there around him. And she gives commands. Let me read through this speech and I'll tell you a little story about it. This is on page 30 in this text. Here's the order she gives to her four little fairy servants. Be kind and courteous to this gentleman. Hop in his walks and gambol in his eyes. Feed him with apricots and dewberries, with purple grapes, green figs, and mulberries. The honey bags steal from the humble bees, and for night tapers crop their waxen thighs and light them at the fiery glowworm's eyes to have my love to bed and to arise. And pluck the wings from painted butterflies to fan the moonbeams from his sleeping eyes. Nod to him, elves, and do him courtesies. Hail, mortal, hail, hail, hail. They all bow to bottom. Now, the poetry is exquisite. Let me explain it in case you missed it. It's beautiful, but what she's telling them to do, okay, play in front of him, delight him with your play. Give him apricots, give him dewberries, go and get purple grapes and green figs and mulberries, feed him with all of those riches of the forest, then go and steal the little honey bags from the bumblebees. Okay? The bumblebees making honey, and as they make honey, the little bags of honey that are on them, and cut off, crop off their waxen thighs. The little bit of wax that's on the back legs of the bees so that when they fly from flower to flower, they get pollen. And pollen spreads throughout and we get new life and new flowers. Take one of those little waxen hairs from their thighs, go to the glowworm, and start the wax on fire by lighting at the glowworm's eyes and make a little torch for a torchlight procession to lead this wonderful man to his bed. It's magical. The imagination in that little speech alone is incomparable. If Shakespeare had written nothing else but those 10 lines, he would have been proclaimed a genius. I got a story to tell you. Absolutely true. And this is the beauty of the play and the magic of great art. I always make my Shakespeare students memorize lines. They have to memorize one sonnet and 50 lines of their own choosing. And they can, you know, break it into a, you know, 10 lines, 20 lines from various plays. This was early on when I started teaching at the Naval Academy. And I had in my class a football player on the Navy football team. They lose all the time, but these guys are, you know, they try hard, they work hard. And he was a big lug of a fellow. Great big lug of a fellow. And he was working hard in the class, he was studying hard, he was doing well. He shows up at my office one morning and says, "Oh, I want to do some lines for you." I said, "Oh yeah, that's fine." I got the little book out, so I said, "How many?" He said, "Oh, it's just about 10, but I'll do some more later." I said, "That's fine. Which play is it from?" He said, "A Midsummer Night's Dream." I said, "Oh, that's good. Which speech are you going to do?" He said, "The Queen of the Fairies." I'm biting through my lip till blood's running down my beard, right? I don't dare laugh. He's worked hard. I said, "Which one?" He said, "Oh, the one where she gives instructions to her little helpers to see bottom to bed that night." Now I'm biting through with both of my eye teeth. I'm shaking to keep from laughing. I swallow and I manage to say, "Why did you memorize that one?" And he said, "Because I like it and it's real pretty." And I swear, talk about mortal grossness being purged and the spirit being elevated. And he came in, sat down, word for word, perfect, and said with real feeling. And it was immensely touching. It was just wonderful. I said, that was very nice, Mr. So-and-so. He said, "Yeah, I think," I said, "what else are you going to learn?" He said, "Well, I thought I'd learn the Agincourt speech from Henry V. I said, "That's good. You could learn that too." And off he went. Okay. The play is not only about magic, the play can produce magic. Quite wonderful. We leave, if you will, Titania and Bottom in the throes of love. We go back to the young lovers. Let me just read something. This is quite nice. It's very clear what's going on here again. Is the question of what's real. What's real, what's not. This is a major theme. Shakespeare is always concerned throughout many of his themes with appearance and reality, and that's certainly the case. That's certainly the case in this play. This is a wonderful old critic. His name is Harold Brooks, who did an edition of the play. And he's talking about the way in which characters in the play mistake certain things for real. The imagination can also make mistakes and not understand, can go out there and not grasp things, which is, again, the problem with love at first sight. The eye takes it in. My imagination creates a person that may not actually exist out there. You need to know about this. It's what I call very often the problem of the first marriage. Young people falling in love, getting married too soon because they've created a false love in their mind and they have no idea who that other person is. It's very curious, but I know many, many, many cases where first marriage failed and a second marriage has gone on quite well. If it's a real marriage, who's to say? But I call it the problem of the first marriage because the imagination has created something that's not there. And after that experience, people become a little more hard-headed. Well, that's a theme here in the play. Let me read Brooks. He's talking here about the mistakes among the lovers in the woods. Remember, we go from the situation, Lysander loves Hermia, Demetrius loves Hermia, nobody loves Helena. Okay? Helena loves Demetrius. We go to a situation where Lysander loves Helena, Helena loves Demetrius, Demetrius loves Hermia, and Hermia loves Lysander. It's a perfect square. And then we go to the point where Lysander loves Helena, Demetrius loves Helena, and nobody loves Hermia. And the joke there is that Helena can't believe both these guys are in love with her. She thinks they're just making fun of her. Love actually comes her way, and she won't believe it. because of the way she's been mistreated in the past. This is Brooks. In the dream, appearance and reality are presented on a series of different planes. At the climax of the entanglement in the lover's quarrel scene, these are to be seen disposed one behind another. The young men's rivalry in courtship and Hermia's suffering are supposed by Helena to be an appearance staged in order to mock her. Hermia's suffering is real enough, though occasioned by a desertion which is not, as she thinks, willful. Lysander hasn't decided to desert her. It's just through magic he's fallen in love with Helena, but forced on Lysander by magic and so lacking normal reality. Unaware that they are under enchantment, the young men regard their rivalry as spontaneous. That is how it appears to them. But in reality, it is induced. By a further complication, Demetrius's induced love of Helena corresponds to his original love. He loved her first before he saw Hermia, which was, and now again, is real. To Puck and Oberon, who know the true causes, the whole imbroglio is a fond pageant. It is a pageant, the audience are aware, which is being performed by actors, two of whom, in appearance, women, are actually boys. There were no women on Shakespeare's stage. The women were played by young boys. I mean, you get appearance, reality, what's going on. It's wonderful. But he's playing these games. He's playing the games and asking, how do we know what is real? But let me emphasize, the point he's making in the play is, there is the real. Bottom is real. The lovers' emotions are real. Marriage is real. The forest is real. The suffering of the young lovers is real. The attempt of the mechanicals to produce art is so real that they can barely have an imagination going on in their empty skulls. And the fairies are real. Okay? The fairies are real. I'm jumping ahead now into Act 4. Jumping ahead into Act 4. I hate to run over the scene with the four young lovers and their quarrel. It's absolutely delightful. Oberon decides his wife has suffered enough. He's going to restore her to sense. We've figured out the confusion that the wrong Athenian youth had the potion put in his eyes, so we're going to correct that. The fairies are there to be benevolent. They're going to work out things for the lovers. Oberon has the little changeling boy. He's happy. He'll restore Titania, and they will be happy again. And notice, Theseus is out hunting, shows up. This is from The Knight's Tale. Theseus goes hunting and finds these people out in the woods. They wake up. And what they discover when they wake up is that everything has been sorted out. Everything has been sorted out. There's a wonderful passage in Act 4, Scene 1. I don't have time to go over it. I just want to point it out to you. This seems like a joke, but it is not. This is absolutely real. Maybe I'll take a minute here. It's only time, which is barely real. They arrive in the woods. And as they enter, Theseus and Hippolyta and Aegeus, Hermia's father, they're talking about the hunting hounds that are with them. Basset hounds, probably, beagles, an assortment of hunting dogs. And what they're talking about is the sound of the dogs barking together. And Theseus says, "We will, fair queen, up to the mountaintop and mark the musical confusion of hounds and echo in conjunction." Let's go up to the top of the mountain. The dogs are going to be running through the woods, chasing after rabbits and foxes and whatever they can find there, and they're all going to be barking. Okay? And then, because we'll go up to the mountain, we'll hear it all echo through the woods, but what we will hear is the musical confusion. And as the different dogs bark at different pitches and on different times, it will be musical. Hippolyta picks up on it. I was with Hercules and Cadmus once, when in a wood of Crete they bayed the bear with hounds of Sparta. Never did I hear such gallant chiding, for besides the groves, the skies, the fountains, every region near seemed all one mutual cry. I never heard so musical a discord, such sweet thunder. I made the point when I started the discussion of Midsummer Night's Dream that Shakespeare takes all these diverse elements and makes one thing out of them. And I think here he's making that clear. You can take the mysteries and contradictions of the world, and they will unite into a wholeness if your perspective is a correct one. And indeed, his vision of the world is a vision of unity. Unlike modernism, which is defied by fragmentation, things breaking down, falling apart, we only look at pieces of things. Think, if you will, of Eliot's Wastelands. Okay, these fragments I have shored against my ruin, little bits and lines of poetry. Think of Picasso's Cubism, those shattered faces that just exist in pieces. Think of Arnold Schoenberg's 12-tone system. Every note is simply there as a tone. It has no musical relation to anything else. That's modernism, fragmentation, breaking apart. Shakespeare, coming out of the medieval world and raised Catholic and still having Catholic sensibility, sees unity. Things that seem to be discordant indeed are unified if you look at them properly. And again, that's the point I was making. It is a wonderful joke that the Queen of the Fairies falls in love with this ass. But there is a kind of mysterious unity in the vision as we see it happen. There is a kind of mysterious oneness that tells us something about the human condition. It's very odd. Let me just read this. They actually did this. They would choose the dogs in hunting packs according to the sound of their bark. This is from 1615. This is just unimaginable. Gervais Markham's Country Contentments. If you would have your kennel for sweetness of cry, then you must compound it of some large dogs that have deep solemn mouths and are swift in spending, quick to give tongue, which must, as it were, bear the bass in the consort, then a double number of roaring and loud ringing mouths which must bear the countertenor, then some hollow, plain, sweet mouths which must bear the mean or middle part. And so, with these three parts of music, you shall make your cry perfect. So when you go to buy dogs for hunting, check out how they bark and where in the musical scale their bark is, and make sure you get it balanced. So when they're running through the woods together, it sounds proper and lovely to the ear. Boy, this is a world we've lost. That's a world we've lost. It's just amazing. Okay, that was a little tangent. They wake up the lovers who don't know what's happened to them, but they are now in agreement. The loves are sorted out, and Demetrius says to Hermia's father, "I don't want her anymore. No, I don't. I want to marry Helena." Helena's amazed. Hermia and Lysander are happy. Theseus says, "Well, Aegeus, if it's worked out this way." Everything has worked out, but please notice, having worked out, we can now go back to the city. The laws of the city can now be properly imposed because order has been restored, and now everyone is in agreement except Aegeus, but he's a good enough man. He will submit to his duke. He will submit to his duke. We are this close to a happy ending. Theseus, Hippolyta, Aegeus ride off. The lovers are left alone, and they are mystified. They don't know what has happened. How comes this gentle concord in the world, Theseus has asked, and they don't know. Hermia, methinks I see these things with parted eye when everything seems double. Wait, wasn't I just here and we were fighting and running around, and now we're all here the next morning, the sun having risen and everything is solved? And finally, are you sure that we are awake? It seems to me that yet we sleep, we dream, says Demetrius. Do not you think the Duke was here and bid us follow him? Yea, and my father, and Hippolyta. And he did bid us follow to the temple. Why then, we are awake. Let's follow him. And by the way, let us recount our dreams. What was real? What was a dream? But we know, because we have been granted the opportunity to see everything that happened. They don't understand fully. We in the audience do. We do. And only one character in the play has been granted the same vision. Bottom, the weaver. the lowest of the low, the dumbest of the dumb. The man with no imagination at all has spent a magical night and been given the grace of clarity of sight and has seen that whole visible, invisible world of the forest. And the last thing that happens in Act 4, Scene 1 is Bottom wakes up. He's all alone again, but he's no longer frightened. He's no longer frightened. He looks around him. His last memory is of when they were rehearsing, so that when he begins speaking, he's talking about being in rehearsal. He wakes up. When my cue comes, call me and I will answer. My next is Most Fair Pyramus. Hi-ho, Peter Quince. Flute the bellows mender, snout the tinkler starveling. God's my life, stolen hence, and left me asleep. I have had a most rare vision. I have had a dream, past the wit of man to say what dream it was. Man is but an ass if he go about to expound this dream. Methought I was, there is no man can tell what. Methought I was, and methought I had, he's feeling for his ears. But man is but a patched fool if he will offer to say what methought I had. The eye of man hath not heard. The ear of man hath not seen. Man's hand is not able to taste, his tongue to conceive, nor his heart to report what my dream was. He knows his scripture a little bit. He's mangling Paul in 1 Corinthians. But the point is, it is not possible for human beings to describe these wonders that he was just exposed to. I will get Peter Quince to write a ballad of this dream. And suddenly, if he's going to describe the mystery he's been through, it will have to be through art. But he knows he's inadequate. So he's going to get Peter Quince, his friend who's the writer, who wrote this magnificent tragedy of Pyramus and Thisbe, he's going to get Peter Quince to write a ballad explaining what happened in the dream. I will get Peter Quince to write a ballad of this dream. It shall be called Bottom's Dream, because it hath no bottom. Now, it has no basis. It rests on nothing, okay? Because it's pure spirit, it's pure vision, it's real, but not in the real sense of hard facts in the world, and it has no bottom. It is open and endless. It is an endless mystery he has just been given a glimpse of. Just a glimpse of it. It shall be called Bottom's Dream because it hath no bottom, and I will sing it in the latter end of a play before the Duke. Peradventure, to make it the more gracious, I shall sing it at her death. At the end of the play, when Thisbe dies, Bottom will sing this song explaining his dream in the woods. He's the only one who saw. He's the only one granted the vision. He wants to turn it into art, and then before the Duke and the lovers at their marriage at the end of the play, he will tell them what he saw. Now, I'm going to skip over the play. I hate to do it. I hate to do it. If you want to have fun some night, get together with friends, read it aloud, act it out. It's unfailingly funny. It's one of the great comic scenes ever created. It's a joy. I've seen professional actors do it to the point where I laughed till my sides ached. I've seen ninth graders do it to the point where my sides ached, because Shakespeare's doing the work for you. All you have to be is honest and a little bit inventive, and this thing is riotous. Riotous. I apologize skipping over it, but let me make one quick point about it. This play had to follow Romeo and Juliet. It had to follow Romeo and Juliet. Because in Pyramus and Thisbe, he's making fun of Romeo and Juliet. And just as with the Greeks, they would do their tragedies and then have a comic afterpiece, Shakespeare, not knowing that, instinctively does the same thing. Having written Romeo and Juliet, he somehow needs to get it out of his system, and he writes a farcical version of it. Essentially the same plot, same story, and it's riotously funny. And then I'm sure he just sort of disposed of it and went on to other things. If he had made mock of it, gentle mockery. If he had made fun of it ahead of time, he then could not have taken it seriously. Romeo and Juliet had to come first. Bottom comes to the end of the play. He's committed suicide. He shreds a passion to tatters. The Theseus and Hippolyta and the four lovers are there, and they're having a great time. It may be lousy art, but they're having fun making comments about it. Pyramus dead, Thisbe dead. Theseus says, moonshine and lion are left to bury the dead. Demetrius says, I and wall too. Fortunately, there's some characters left. And Bottom leaps up. No, I assure you, the wall is down that parted their fathers. Will it please you to see the epilogue or to hear a bergamasque dance between two of our company? No epilogue, Theseus says, I pray you, for your play needs no excuse. No more. No, stop there. But what happens? We don't hear Bottom's dream. Theseus says, no more. No, that's fine. No more. We never hear it. It is lost art, if you will. Who knows what was in it? Who knows what he put down? We'll never know. All we'll know, and I call it one of the great lost pieces of art, Bottom's dream, which hath no bottom, and we never will find out what it is. Where does that come from? Let me make a point. This is another one of White's crackpot theories. I sincerely believe there are only three characters in Shakespeare that speak for the man himself. All the other characters, all the other plays, he is just creating situations and the characters are out there running. The three, Hamlet, who I think gives voice to Shakespeare's troubled soul at a dark point in his life and career. I think we hear Shakespeare's voice. Prospero in The Tempest. His last play, he's going into retirement, he's saying farewell, he's giving up his art, and we hear him ending his career, leaving London, saying goodbye to the theater, knowing his life is about to end and giving us his last thoughts. But the third one, Bottom the Weaver. And I am absolutely convinced in that little speech when Bottom wakes up, we hear Shakespeare's voice, who had suddenly been granted a gift of vision that few other people had ever had and was mystified at what had happened. Imagine, if you will, you're a young playwright, you've got a little bit of talent, you've written some good plays, and then suddenly the company says, Will, we need another play next month. Okay, I'll write something. You sit down, you take blank sheets of paper, and you write Romeo and Juliet. Imagine coming to the end of that play and looking at the work you had just put down on paper. And if you had any sense at all, you would say, I've had a most rare vision. I've had a most rare vision. And in all humility, Shakespeare understands not the ego of, boy, am I a talented playwright, but what have I been allowed to see? Where did that come from? And bingo, Richard II, Midsummer Night's Dream, and there's no looking back. Genius comes in two ways. One, Mozart coming out of the womb writing music, okay? Writing little violin sonatas when he's 4 years old, writing his first symphony at age 7, writing his first opera at age 11. We can't grasp it, okay? We can't grasp it. And the music just pouring out of him for the rest of his life. The famous Skittles trio, he's off with friends bowling, playing lawn bowling. And in the midst of it, okay, he suddenly grabs paper and runs over and starts writing. And they say, you know, Wolfgang, it's your turn. Oh, yeah, okay, gets the ball, he rolls, boom, and he runs back. He writes some more down. Are you going to play or are you going to fool around? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay, gets the ball, he bowls some more, he runs back, he's writing. And at the end, we've got the great horn trio. And I think he probably won the game of Skittles, too. It's called the Skittles Trio. Where does it come from? They asked him, how do you do that? He said, well, the music comes into my head, I just have to put it down. He is the conduit. It's inspiration. He was always like that. Apparently Michelangelo was like that. He'd go and stand at those quarries outside of Florence for weeks, just looking at chunks of marble. Then he'd say, okay, that one. Haul that one back to my studio. And they'd say, what are you doing out there? He'd say, I'm looking for the hunk of marble that has the statue in it. Then I get it to my workshop. I just have to let the statue out. What? What? The rest of us don't think that way. It's just sheer genius. The second kind of genius, somebody with a little talent, who's done some good work, who suddenly skyrockets into genius. If you're a born genius, your own genius probably doesn't surprise you. But to be pretty talented, if Shakespeare had died in 1593, he'd be remembered, but he'd be one of a stable of really good playwrights. But all of a sudden, something happened, and mere talent shot up into genius. We look at it and say, wow, what happened? How did he do that? Imagine if you're the one it happens to. And you've written Love's Labour's Lost, and it's pretty good. And you've written Richard III, and that's a pretty good play. And then you write Romeo and Juliet, and then Richard II, and then A Midsummer Night's Dream. And his stance, I think, bottom stance. Who am I? A yokel from Stratford with a little education, not knowing much, being given this gift to see these things that others aren't seeing? Act 5 opens with a debate between Theseus and Hippolyta on the nature of the imagination. I don't have time to go into it, but let me say this. Theseus simply says, the poet, the lunatic, and the lover are all alike in imagination. Okay? All they have, they make up things that aren't there. The lover creates love, creates wonders in the beloved. The madman sees devils everywhere that aren't there. And the poet makes up things that never existed. And Theseus says, no, the imagination is just, there's nothing. It's making something out of nothing. And Hippolyta, referring to those young lovers, says, no, no, no. They all tell the same story. They all tell the same story. There was something out in that woods. There's something out in the woods. Hippolyta is right. We know it. Why? Because we've seen it. We got to see it along with Bottom. There is a world of the spirit that is real. It is a special gift to understand that and have some notion of it. Hippolyta intuits it. The young lovers benefit from it. Bottom got to see it. Shakespeare put it down for the rest of his career. At the end, the couples go off to their beds. It's the marriage night. It's a happy night. And they don't see that those blessed spirits come into the house to bless them. And what do they bless them with? They take the dew from the morning, consecrate it, and sprinkle it around the house. This is a Catholic thought. The simple, real objects of this world can be made holy and can bless us. Shakespeare does it again in a lighthearted way, but only a Catholic writer could have even imagined such a thing. That the dew on the flowers in the morning can be consecrated and become holy water to bless the marriage bed. And at the end, it's Puck who gives the epilogue and reminds us, if we shadows have offended, okay, think but this, and all is mended that you have but slumbered here while these... Just pretend the play was a dream, because it wasn't real either. Performance ends, it's all gone. Yes, except great art by a great genius reminds us of those worlds beyond the five senses that Shakespeare knew are real worlds, and this that we think is real, this material world, will pass away, but we are headed to that other world where reality will exist for eternity, and that's the world of the spirit. And some are granted the gift to see into it, to participate in it, to understand it, while still living in time in the here and now.